After summer, where the budget took up much of the state legislature's time, lawmakers are turning their attention to other issues. Meanwhile, D's and R's are starting to shake out their candidates for next year's statewide races. Keeping an eye on all of the above are Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. They're in to help us all get a handle on what's hot here in the capital city of Columbus this week on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
A drug problem that is out of control, a governor who's spending a lot of time talking about issues of consequence beyond Ohio, declining state revenues, charter school questions, energy issues, and many more items are on the minds of state lawmakers. And for more than a handful of politicians, winning a job such as governor is top of mind. To bring us up to speed on all things politics and policy in Columbus, two veteran journalists who follow state government are our guests today. Julie Carr Smythe is with the Associated Press. Jim Siegel is with the Columbus Dispatch. Both are return guests. Julie, Jim, welcome back to Town Hall, Ohio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I mentioned tax revenues as one of the many things that are facing lawmakers and all of government and citizenry for that matter. So, Jim, maybe start us off. Money isn't coming in at the pace that it was projected to.
Well, it definitely didn't last year. The budget last year finished about, and the budget ends in the fiscal year at the end of June, finished at 800, revenues came in about $850 million below estimates. And that's particularly bad because those estimates were actually revised downward by a few hundred million 12 months earlier. So those were already adjusted revenue estimates, and then we missed those by $850 million. So it was a problem. They had to, luckily for the state, we tend to overestimate how much we're going to spend on Medicaid, which is our biggest driver of spending in the state. That's the state federal health care program. And so we underspent there, which helped us not cause too many problems in terms of having to, you know, fix a major budget crisis at the end of the year. But it did definitely cause them to have to reduce what they expected to come in for the new two-year budget, which just started July 1st. And the good news is those new estimates have been on target so far. Now, it's only been 2 months. If you go back to the beginning of the last budget, the budget revenue estimates weren't too bad in the first 2 months either. But at least so far through 2 months, I mean, our revenues are up about about 0.7% over estimates right now. And the good thing is, I think it's 2.8% above last year, which is a good sign that the revenues are tax revenues are growing again. One of the big problems last year was that you actually saw a year-to-year decline in the income tax, not just missing estimates, but an actual drop in income tax revenue.
Yeah, Julie, I wanted to follow up on that. And we're going to have a couple of economists on the show next week that are going to give us the real story here. But what have you heard? What are they talking about for the reasons for the lowering, especially of the income tax receipts?
Well, it's a little bit of a mystery, actually. You know, the budget department has said that they couldn't figure out exactly what had happened. But, of course, there are those who say that the jobs we do have and the jobs that are being created within the Kasich administration don't have the wages and the high pay that had been before. And so, therefore, when people go to pay their taxes, it's less. There are a number of other reasons as well that there was kind of a loophole in there that was given to a break to certain people. And then I don't know that the budget department has actually figured out whether that was what the cause was.
I think they've tried to say, I think you're talking about the business, right? The business income tax deduction, which I believe a number of farmers qualify for as pass-through entities. Joe, I'm not familiar with how they're set up.
Any
but I
tax
believe,
break farmers get, they deserve. That's yeah. all.
Well,
I
of course. But I'm guessing a lot of family farmers are set up that way as pass through entities, and they qualify for that too. But I mean, it's $1.1 billion a year in income tax that is not coming in because of that exemption. That's the 200. You don't pay income tax up to $250,000 in income, and then any income over 250, you actually get another 40% tax cut. So. The tax department and Republicans have tried very hard to say no, that is not the cause, but critics of that deduction say that it's certainly not helping things in terms, and that's strictly from looking at it from the view of state revenue, not looking at it from the view
policy
of
point of view, right?
Right.
So speaking of policy and numbers, the budget, Jim referenced that we're a couple of months into the new fiscal year, but I haven't had anybody like you guys in here to help me pick it apart yet, so we'll back up just a little bit. To me, one of the more significant pieces of news that came from the budget was that the governor overrode or vetoed several different provisions, primarily, I think, in the Medicaid area, and then the legislature came back and overrode those vetoes. So, Julie, what was bigger news, the changes to the actual budget or the fact that a Republican House and a Republican governor didn't get together there?
That I think the second was exactly right. Now, it was very interesting because the governor came in and there had been, I think, 17 items that he vetoed, I think. Or,
total?
Yeah.
47.
Or 47, I'm sorry. But they came back on something like 11 to 17 that they were going to look at. What he was mostly pushing back on is he supports the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. And most of the Republicans in the legislature differ with the governor on that. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, is a sticking point with those in the Republican Party. Our governor is a rare person within the party to kind of say, well, not entirely rare. There have been some other Republican governors who accepted that money. His argument being that it helps the the
people who need it.
the people in the most need, right? Exactly. And also that it will help with the budget, you know. And I think that when Jim's talking about the revenue problems that we had, that actually Kasich tried to get out in front of that because his claim to fame, which we're going to get into him later, but, you know, is sort of he's a budget balancer. And when this is happening, he didn't, you know, he was trying to get out in front of like, wow, my own budget isn't going to balance. And here I've got all of these kind of national stakes in this game. So anyway, the lawmakers came back and they weren't able, the most significant thing, they weren't able to override. They claimed that they could have, but they decided not to. But, you know, you'll never know if you don't call the vote, was to actually stop the expansion itself. So he did several other smaller pieces of that and did veto them, and they came back and overrode those in both chambers.
Yeah, veto overrides are very rare in this state. We have only had before the Senate vote, there had only been two veto overrides in the last 38 years in Ohio, and there's a reason for that. I mean, for a lot of that time, Republicans controlled both the legislature and the governor's office. And so there's only been three times before this in the entire history of the state where a Republican legislature had overridden a Republican governor. Well, it's now happened six times in the last month. So we could go through a lot. I'm trying not to get too much into the weeds on this, but the basic issue here is this is a power struggle between the executive and legislative branches. The legislature wants more power, more control over Medicaid spending. As I mentioned earlier, Medicaid is the largest part of the state budget. Spends, oh God, billions of dollars per year. A lot of it's federal money, but it is still billions of dollars that comes through the budget. And the legislature feels like the governor's office has kind of seized a little too much control over that. This also stems back to when Medicaid expansion was first approved back in 2013. The governor was able to approve it without a full vote of the legislature. So there's still lingering, you know, resentment about that. So bottom line, that is underlying a lot of what you're seeing here with these override votes. There's been six overrides that have been successful so far.
Jim Siegel is a State House reporter with the Columbus Dispatch. Julie Carr-Smythe does the same job with the Associated Press. So, Julie, Are you getting a little less FaceTime these days with Governor Kasich? He is, he says he's not running, but I'm telling you, he's spending an awful lot of time on broad national issues. I'm not saying that's good or bad, but it's a fact.
Yes, absolutely. And we are seeing the governor less. He seems to come to town, or at least come to the State House and make appearances on a much more rare basis, picking and choosing things. For example, he signed a bill the other day that was to increase penalties for those who mutilate a loved one, or I mean a girl, ex-girlfriend or something. And so he did that, and really, I notice every time I see the governor that even when he is talking about Ohio issues, he's picking issues that will play nationally. I mentioned when he got the legislative leaders together on this budget gap, when he comes in here and he does sort of a photo op, if you will, with the daughters of a woman who was burned by her ex-boyfriend. These are things that, you know, he could use for his resume. You know, I feel like Ronald Reagan said, you know, here we go again. 4 years ago, he was saying he wasn't going to run. Obviously, he did decide to run. And actually, it's very interesting because he's so out there as a naysayer to the president, you know, that there's some discussion about would he take him on in a primary, which would be very unique to take on a sitting president, let alone what if he ran, you know, as under a separate label of some kind. So I think you could argue whether it's good or bad to have such a high-profile governor for those in the state of Ohio. I mean, there's some positive things to it, but he certainly does get pushback for not being present here.
Yeah, I have no idea if the governor's really interested in running in 2020 for anything, but I think he sees a void and he's trying to fill it on a national level, and that void is a lack of rational, deep thinking conversation about, well, practically anything anymore in Washington. We just don't get it, and it's not necessarily either party's fault, although the Republicans are in control, so they're going to share the blame right now for that. But look, I mean, he gets together with Governor Hickenlooper out in Colorado, and they come up with an outline of a health care plan that they think could kind of keep people covered and help even though it wouldn't completely get rid of Obamacare, it would make some changes. And I think he's stepping into where he sees a need for some adult conversation on some of these issues that he knows it's just not happening amongst the leaders in Congress, and particularly the president right now.
So. Julie, quickly, that bipartisan approach, has it played out in his 6 years as governor of the state of Ohio, 7 years?
It has to some extent, but, you know, he's generally sort of tried to, he can't really get with the Republicans, let alone with the Democrats as well, and some Democrats will tell you that he hasn't, but you know, somebody, he has put Democrats on, for example, the police task force on violence, and so I think that he's tried to reach out. Teresa Fetter would tell you as well that he's worked on human trafficking.
We will be back to talk about some other key issues, including the exploding drug crisis in Ohio. Jim Siegel and Julie Carr Smythe will be back right after this.
How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. 7 little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
Welcome back to Town Hall, Ohio. State House reporters Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch are in with us. And Julie, I got to admit, I don't pick up my newspaper anymore. I log on to my newspaper. It's yours, Jim, by the way. And
appreciate that.
But I also monitor the AP stories and most other news outlets in Ohio, and it breaks my heart because every day you read some story about yet another drug overdose, statistics showing the enormity of of the number of people dying. Dayton, one of the worst places in America. It's horrible. How high on the agenda is it for our policymakers who might be able to help us figure some things out?
It is absolutely the top issue right now. And you'll notice when you hear politicians talking about it, that we don't see the type of promises such as, you know, we vow to reduce the number of opioid deaths by 25% by 2025 or something like that. And the reason for that is they really don't know how to fix it. There are a lot of things underway within the budget. There was a lot of spending on some new approaches, things like added converting some old vacant nursing home beds into treatment beds, maybe working more within the court system and on education, addiction intervention, and that kind of thing. So that is a priority. The administration often mentions that it's spending $1 billion on the problem. And one of the interesting things, I think, to watch is that the Third Frontier Commission is launching a campaign similar to what Under Armour had done with the NFL after the concussion crisis, to kind of bring out innovative ideas for fixing the problem, fixing the root causes of the problem. So they have that getting ready to launch, and they're also putting out grants for, big institutions, Ohio State, Cleveland Clinic, as well as small business people, just with ideas of maybe unique ways to tackle the pain problem and the addiction problem.
Yeah, it's Julie's right. It's the top issue right now. We had more than 4,000 deaths last year from overdose, and that is a staggering number considering that we thought it was staggering in 2015 when more than 3,000 people died. We're getting reports from Franklin County and other big counties that already the numbers are even higher this year so far. And so it's continuing to trend the wrong way. And in Southwest Ohio, I just read something about the drug overdoses are resulting in deaths at twice the national rate in Southwest Ohio. There's a sheriff down there who has proudly proclaimed that his deputies are not going to carry naloxone, which is the drug to revive people from drug overdoses. But now Hamilton County has put out they're trying to distribute about 30,000 doses of this drug that try to helps bring people back. They're trying very hard to find, we need more treatment beds. We need more options. This fentanyl issue, fentanyl is being mixed in with these other drugs that it's killing people left and right now. It's hard to get your arms around it.
And we should mention too that the Attorney General has filed a suit against the pharmaceutical industry. Just this week, they have pushed back and obviously said that they oppose that and want that suit to be dropped. So there are legal efforts, there are legislative efforts, there are administrative efforts. Everybody sort of put all hands on deck. And what's interesting to watch for everybody is, will solutions involve additional pharmaceuticals? Because the pharmaceutical industry is kind of increasingly talked about as on the hook for this problem. So naloxone, people are beginning to push back against that. Oh, it's another pharmaceutical solution. And some of the things within the Third Frontier proposals are not that. They're more homeopathic things, massage, wraps that you can put on post-surgery that relieve pain in ways other than with opioids.
I might throw out, besides government engagement, community involvement is high too. Ohio Farm Bureau has it as one of its most high priority issues. And we've got our groups in rural county farm bureaus that are looking at ways they can address the issue in Ohio's small communities too. Julie, let's turn to clean energy standards. And we had rules and then we put them on hold and then where are we?
I get as confused as anybody because it changes by the day. But as of right now, I think that the governor vetoed a bill that would have completely reversed Ohio's clean energy standard, which was set under the Strickland administration.
Which included so much from renewables and so much from
Right. I mean, it was phrased to say alternative energy as opposed to clean energy. So clean coal was in there, but also wind, solar, and that kind of thing. So he sort of pushed back, and then the legislature came back and held a series of hearings trying to revise it. You know, there's a senator leading this charge, Bill Seitz, who really does believe, and he's a voice for a lot of others in the legislature that just believes that these clean energy standards are mandates that are really hurting the economy, and that energy is such a huge issue. So they've continued to work on trying to find something that would be palatable to the governor.
Well, we'll be back in just a couple of moments with more from our guests, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch and Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press. They both follow state government here in Columbus. Medical marijuana, some things going on with charter schools, and maybe a return to some interest in figuring out less partisan ways to shape our congressional districts. Those and more when we continue. As a media relations person for Farm Bureau, that's not true. It's a good day when neither of you call me. I just want to let you know. Julie Carr Smythe is with the Associated Press. Jim Siegel is with the Columbus Dispatch. Both are State House reporters. And Julie, I'm trying to remember exactly when we did it, but the last general election, we passed a medical marijuana law in the state of Ohio, and it's in the process of getting to where it can actually take place. But in terms of the rules for growers, distributors, physicians, dispensers, it seems like it's moving pretty slowly.
That is definitely the feeling of the growers, particularly because we're now a year out from when the law was supposed to be effective. I mean, the law itself was effective, but it set a timetable that by next September we would be able to launch this very elaborate system that would include growing it, testing it, marketing it, selling it through these dispensaries. And so what the Medical Marijuana Commission has said is basically, we didn't tell you we'd have these rules in place a year out. And the growers are saying, the Growers Association says, well, if you don't, how are we going to know for sure, you know, where we're going to build, how we're going to grow? And certainly farmers can understand that, you know, you have to have things in place in time for a season. Although I think a lot of this will be, you know, hydroponic and that kind of
indoor
thing. Right. So that's where it stands right now. We're about a year out, and there are a lot of uncertainties.
So we here in Ohio a few years ago, Jim, launched a constitutional commission that they were going to look at a variety of things about our constitution. That's been disbanded. They didn't get their work done, apparently. But one big part that people thought would be taking under that organization would be looking at finding a less partisan way to pick our members of the United States Congress. Commission aside, that idea might have some new life.
Yeah, the legislature passed a bill 2 years ago to reform, and the voters approved it, to reform the way we draw legislative districts. And
for our state house,
for the state house, and but they did not do anything about congressional districts for a variety of reasons, including pressure from then Speaker John Boehner, who simply did not want the process changed because, surprise, surprise, the process allows him to win 12 out of 16 seats and without breaking much of a sweat. But there is continuing to be concern that this is a bad system for drawing districts. And, you know, you pack voters together, you crack them apart in order to make sure that you maximize your benefit. And then you end up with a map like we have now where, like I said, Republicans control 12 out of 16 seats and the races are almost never competitive.
Yeah, but the Republicans, probably because of what you just said, would never move. But it looks to me like we're getting more of the casino effect, the same way we got a marijuana bill. Mm-hmm. The legislature never would have written a medical marijuana bill until they said, well, it's going to be on the ballot. We better have control of this. Same way with the redistricting?
Yes, there is a Fair Districts Equals Fair Elections coalition, including the League of Women Voters and others that are in the process of getting signatures to put an issue on the November 2018 ballot that would reform this. It would put it in the hands of an elected panel rather than letting the legislature draw the lines. Lawmakers are very much not in favor of losing control of that process. So there have now been actual, like, real discussions going on about doing some kind of congressional redistricting reform. And like you said, finding a less partisan way to draw these lines so that, you can really manipulate a map in a way that can really change how not only the Ohio's representation, but also what happens in Washington. I mean, because of the way that Republicans control state government across the nation, they were able to pick up dozens of seats simply because of the way they redrew the lines.
And this is gaining steam nationally as well. We saw our governor hop into a multiple governor effort with one of the most well-known former governors, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who they're trying to push the same thing nationally. And what they're saying is that hyper-partisan maps at the to elect congressional people is really responsible for the kind of dialogue or lack thereof that we're having nationally right now. And some, I guess you could call them brave Republicans, have to come out and say, you know, wow, our own party is in control of everything now. That doesn't make it right, because, you know, obviously every politician knows that this tide shifts by the cycle, and the next time it might not be your party, it might be your party that is upended, and then you're in the same situation with hyper-partisan control on the other side.
And I was going to say, and the actual impact of this, if you're let's think about it. If you're a congressman and you either, one, you never have to really worry about losing an election, or two, your only concern is being primaried from your right or left, that has dramatic impacts on how you act as a legislator, as a congressman.
If your job is safe, you don't ever have to compromise.
Well, and it's interesting, yep, because I interviewed Kasich on this, and he made the point that the it actually is it used to be when you had a safe district, you could actually get things done because you didn't have to worry all the time. And now the opposite is the case, as you say. Now they don't have to compromise.
We will be back to talk more with veteran State House journalists Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch and Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press. More on Town Hall, Ohio, right after this. We're looking at what's going on in the state capitol with Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch here in the last number of months. Jim, there have been a variety of sources looking at the charter school system, and one in particular, but Auditor Dave Yost seems to have come to the conclusion that these schools have not been nearly accountable enough and that they need to fix their problems. What's happening there with the whole review of charter schools and ECOT in particular?
Well, with ECOT, they continue to have a problem with their enrollment verification. As an online school, this, you know, you don't just get students who show up at the door and then you count the heads. You got to try to find other ways to figure out if they're actually attending class, and that's been an ongoing fight. The state says that they owe them. The state says the ECOT owes back $60 million because they were unable to verify their enrollment from a few years ago. A big chunk of their enrollment, about 60%, in fact. And that fight just the Supreme Court just accepted the appeal on that. The ECOT has lost. The Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow is ECOT, by the way. The ECOT has lost every round in the court so far, but it's now in front of the Supreme Court. Based on some of the rulings we've seen and some of the stuff we've seen out of the Supreme Court so far, I wouldn't say their chances are very good, but they're still trying to fight and keep the state from taking the $60 million. In the meantime, ECOT's trying to switch over to become what's known as a dropout recovery school. By doing that, they would basically lower the standards they have to meet. And this matters because that means their sponsor will get a better grade and be able to continue sponsoring schools, including ECOD. It's a big whirlwind of
I'm going to keep my editorial comment to myself on that one. Julie, right now, I guess a good profession in Ohio would be to be a television advertising salesman, because we're a ballot state, a ballot measure state. This whole drug price proposal, the commercials have just been on and on and on. Tell us what the issue is. Help us sort it out a little bit.
Okay, so what Ohioans will be voting on is whether or not to require the state to match prices that are offered by the U.S. Office of Veterans Affairs. The reason for that is that the VA gets very good discounts, some say 25% or so. And so the proponents of this measure are trying to force down drug prices. That would be it, kind of their premise in a nutshell. Now, there are a lot of caveats to this. One is the opponents, who include pharma, so we can't say that they don't, but they're saying it's not that easy to determine what the discount is that the VA gets. It would be very hyper meticulous to try to get this. Some of that is proprietary. These discounts are offered in a way that can't really be calculated effectively. I've talked to some people at different bureaus that would be affected, say the Bureau of Workers' Comp, and they say, well, what if we only say we'll match the lower price, but then the customer gets to the pharmacy and they wind up having to pay that difference, which some people are worried that could be an issue. In addition to that, it has a provision in it which says that the state would have to pick up the legal fees for fighting this. And this is the piece, an element that caused it to fail in California.
So I'm going to show some of my skepticism here. And by the way, full disclosure, Ohio Farm Bureau has official policy that opposes this ballot measure. But here's where the skeptic comes in. I find it hard to believe that somebody just out of the goodness of their heart wants me to pay lower prices for my prescription drugs. Who's behind the proposal, and what's their stake in the race?
Well, there's a group or an entity, actually, who is it's an HIV California-based organization that is probably the biggest user of these sorts of drugs in the country. And so they do have a personal stake in the race, and as well as a personal stake in a financial stake. You know, drug related advocacy groups are involved on both sides of this. It's very muddy in that way. I tried to put in records requests with all the state entities that would be involved, and that wasn't even possible because, you know, in one of the analyses, it said that, oh, it made an estimate that related to the impact it might have on STRS and some of the other retirement funds. Then when I speak to the retirement funds, I say, we read it that we're not even affected by it. And so some of the discounts that you hear and the reductions that you hear estimates on, it really you have to take with a grain of salt. So it's murky. Definitely the two arguments are, on the one side, if you get a big entity like the state to pull down prices and force down prices, that will have an impact, begin to have an impact nationally. And on the other side, that this is just too muddy to get a yes vote.
We'll be back to wrap up our visit with Julie Carr-Smythe and Jim Siegel when we continue.
Get your morning paper. Get your morning paper. I'm here to shout it, read all about it. Get your morning paper.
Our guests put news in your morning newspaper or on your online subscription. Jim Siegel is with the Columbus Dispatch. Julie Carr-Smythe with Associated Press. They both cover the State House. So we have some primaries coming up next year that are going to help us determine who's going to be the next governor of Ohio and all statewide offices. Jim, can you alphabetically by height list the 47 people who want to be our next governor?
No, but I was really excited yesterday when I went to my mailbox and found my first attack piece in the mail attacking Jim Renacci, who's one of the Republicans running for governor. And so, yeah, I checked my calendar. I'm like, yeah, we are still you know, like 9 months away from this primary, right? And yeah, we are, but it's starting early and it's getting going. I mean, there, you know, there's four Republicans running there, and Attorney General Mike DeWine, Secretary of State John Husted, Congressman Jim Renacci, and Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor. Four heavy hitting Republicans who are, you know, the field will probably thin out before next May, but as of right now, this is shaping up to be a big battle. Renacci and Husted have been going at each other, and you know, it's going to be an interesting fight. The Democrats have four also. Right. I could let Julie talk about that. But
yeah, I was out in Martins Ferry this week for the first debate among the Democratic candidates. They are a former Congresswoman Betty Sutton, former State Rep Connie Pillich, State Senator Joe Schiavone, and Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. Now, on this side, it's very interesting because we have talk that the consumer finance chief, Richard Cordray, who, of course, was our former Ohio Attorney General, and maybe TV host Jerry Springer hopping in on the Democratic side. So
what could go wrong with a celebrity being involved in a key?
Sounds like a winner.
That's right. So it was interesting in this debate. It wasn't exactly a debate, although they do have some policy differences. But I think that the Democratic Party is going to be hosting these events around the state because they need to raise their visibility of all their candidates, or at least one that might come up to the top and be able to take on a heavy hitter like a Mike DeWine or a John Husted.
So for the D's, it's pretty simple. We don't like Trump. It's a little more complicated for the R's, right?
That's absolutely right, because they have to walk that line. Their own party is divided on this. We saw this past week Pat Tiberi, who's a moderate congressman on the Republican side, start a caucus, or that he's leading a caucus called the Governing Caucus in the Congress, as if that's sort of a unique thing that you might do when you're in Washington in the Congress. So, you know, Republicans do have to figure out a way to distinguish themselves without alienating the Trump supporters on the Republican side. And Renacci, particularly, is fighting that fight and pushing the more those who have been more moderate, who are now trying to be more conservative, to take sides in that, because he thinks that's his way to win, is to look like a Trump candidate.
And at the top of the ticket for the Republicans will likely be Josh Mandel running for U.S. Senate. Now, he has a primary with Mr. Gibbons, Mike Gibbons. But if he's the favorite in that, and he has been very much a big Trump supporter as well. So you're going to definitely see some folks on the Republican side trying to attach themselves to Trump and ride that wave. The question is, will the wave still exist next year? But with the way things have been going in Washington, and I'm not about to tell you that I'm going to predict that one way or another, but that is going to definitely play in. And in Ohio, it's going to play with all these Republicans because they are in power now. So a lot of, you know, when it comes down to that, it's do you like the way things are going in Ohio, or don't you? And do you think it's time for some leadership change? In 2006, we saw that the Democrats rose up and won most of the statewide seats. They lost them again 4 years later and haven't had them back since. But it does happen, and we'll see how the state is feeling about things around this time next year.
Right, and we've seen that a number of the candidates have, you know, they came out for Trump, and then they went against him after the tape about the Billy Bush weekend, they call it. And then once he got elected, folks like Rob Portman have had to come out and say, well, you know, yes, I did oppose him, but now I need to work with him. And so all that is yet to be determined.
I will tell you that if you want to follow what's going on down at the State House and you read the work of Julie Carsmyth or Jim Siegel, you're going to get a very accurate accounting of what's actually happening. Thanks to both of you for joining us. We'll be back with another episode of Town Hall Ohio 1 week from today.
Town Hall Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall Ohio.